You are listening to the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast, episode 292. If it's not a flying car, then this isn't a podcast. Welcome to season 7, episode 292 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is April the 30th, 2017. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and not watching The Circle because it looks trite and stupid is my brother, James Furlough. Did you?
Yeah.
We did not coordinate that.
No.
On purpose.
No, we didn't. I just knew that was the latest movie, The Circle, coming out, which is awesome because I actually changed the intro for the recording, so people are going to be like, what's he talking about? my intro was for the West Tech Podcast, running circles around technology. Yeah, number 4 in the box office.
I know.
And, I mean, everyone expected The Fast and the Furious or The Furious Fate or whatever it's called to be number 1, but no, it was number 4. And from what I read a review from a guy who read the book, and it was the classic, the book was great, the movie was horrible. Like, oh, okay, yeah, whatever. But he was like, it didn't have any time to develop anything, and who really knew, and, you know, whatever.
Man, it's funny, because I read a couple of reviews, and one of the, like, continuing themes was, the book is, like, is not actually very great. I mean, like, because, and the problem is that these are, like, they just feel like plastic. The book does a very good job of developing the...
Sorry, you said they feel like plastic what? You stopped for, like, half a second.
Oh, sorry. They feel like plastic cutout people. They're not real people. They're not well developed. And so even though, like the core conflict of, you know, these tech companies run amok...
It's kind of ironic.
I know, yeah. The like core idea of these tech companies run amok was very well developed in the book. They were like, that was what they were excited about for the movie, is it had this opportunity to really, especially with the cast that it had, to really, like, you know, bring it home and create these great characters, these great, you know, and try to humanize it and make it more personal. And they failed not only to do that, but then they didn't have enough time to really develop, like, the scary, like, I've not seen the movie, probably won't see the movie, but I've read a lot about it. And they're just like,
I know, I was interested in it, and yeah, now I'm not at all.
Because it's like, this is supposed to be like Google is The Circle, it's like the same company, but they don't have a Google product. They have, like, they invented this, like, online ID thing where, like, in order to use the internet, you had to use this online ID. Huh. And they somehow got, like, it legislation passed that required people to have it. And it, like, stopped bullying on the internet because people had their, like, real ID, which is just, like, bullying. Yeah, you say Google's bullying happens on Facebook and people are supposed to use their real ID. So I'm not exactly sure that would fix anything. I don't know. And they just, like, I don't know. It's just, it's funny reading these criticisms of, what were you people thinking? Why did you make this movie? What is going on? Well,
probably, like, looked better in their minds.
Probably. Well, I described it as trite. I mean, and like, trite being, like, uncreative, uninventive, just not very, like, it's not very forward thinking. That's what this seems like, is they're basically like, well, hey, you know, people are afraid of the NSA and Google having too much information, so we'll just make a movie that sort of throws around those like keywords, and people will be afraid of it. Failing to, like, realize that, yeah, people know what Facebook is and they do it anyways. they don't hate it. Like, they.
And it's not like Facebook has some secret nefarious thing that it's doing that no one's really aware of either. I mean, like, we all know they're tracking everything and trying to figure out more ways to track us.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's a given.
It's nefarious.
I look at the ads and go, holy cow, they know me.
Yeah, they're definitely.
And then I buy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know. I just don't think it's.
I'm safe with Twitter. Twitter doesn't get me quite as much. which I find is weird. I actually am a lot more interactive on Twitter. They're just not as good.
Yeah, well, yeah. They've got less money.
Yeah, I listened to the podcast Startup, and they just finished a 2-part series on Friendster, which was super interesting because they were like the first social network. They had the patent on the concept of social networking, which is like
that. Awesome. Yeah.
But it talks about essentially the reason why they failed came down to two things.
Because the patent was meaningless. What? Because the patent was meaningless.
No, actually, they ended up selling it to Facebook.
Oh, for really?
Buku bucks. Okay, that was one of the ways they recouped their investment. Apparently. But it was two things. Number one, you couldn't just spin up more servers on AWS at the time.
Yeah.
They had their own server farm. And they had to buy servers and install them. And they just, it took off so fast, they literally could not keep up. And which, like, Twitter's problem, but even worse. And then the second thing was just mismanagement. The guy running it, they were running for 6 years and had 7 CEOs in that amount of time. They just could not wrap their head around it. And it was trouble. But it was interesting, the guy at the founder of it, you know, he got a nice buyout and everything. And they were like, so are you kind of upset about the fact that, you know, you get Facebook, who's created billionaires from the idea, and you're not? And he goes, I'll be honest, I don't feel bad for me. I'm still a millionaire. Like, I'm okay.
Yeah. You know? I'll find a way to survive.
I survive. And he goes, and honestly, their original idea was for you to use your real identity online and connect to your real friends. Like, yeah, that was the crux of the idea. And he goes, I actually feel vindicated that that's what won out. He goes, I feel good that my original idea was what worked.
Okay.
And so,
in all fairness, when you like judge that, I was looking at an infographic from Our Data is Beautiful earlier this week, and they were showing the 4 biggest websites on the internet for unique visitors and page clicks. So, yeah. and they didn't get exactly into how they ranked them all using those two metrics, but
it's magic.
But Facebook was like Google, YouTube, Facebook were the top 3. Unsurprisingly, Google was actually bigger than Facebook, and I think that's all about your page clicks. Because I go to Facebook a couple of times. I go to Google all the time. But Reddit was in 4th place.
Really?
And it's been
what could go wrong
stuff. Exactly. Took off. And you sit there and you go like, and a lot of that has to do with is it's kind of an anonymous social network. It's what would Facebook be if nobody used their real identity? And in a lot of ways, I would say. I think there's value, and I think there's a value to people in both of those categories. Interesting. But all I can say is that the Circle, they had 7 days to get the job done, and they're not going to make it because Guardians of the Galaxy is coming this weekend, and I think I'm actually going to
see that one on Friday.
Nice. I'm not going to see it till Saturday.
Well, that will still work.
Girlfriend moved out of town, so gotta
bummer.
Gotta coordinate better.
I don't know. I put the Circle on my Fandango favorites or hearts list or whatever it's called because I was interested. But man, the closer it got, I heard it had like 18 on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah,
isn't great as a general.
It's not a passing grade, that's for sure.
Which I know, like, people weren't crazy about, what was it, Steve Jobs or The Social Network, but like, because it doesn't stick true to the core.
Right.
Like, yeah, but it's entertaining at least.
Yeah, but it's a really good movie. That's the thing.
That's what they were going for, not historical accuracy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It does make me wonder. Social Network. I love Rotten Tomatoes.
Rotten Tomatoes. You use that so often. I'm not quite as conversant in it as you are.
I go to
Rotten Tomatoes. I use IMDb a lot, but just not Rotten Tomatoes, which I think they have both.
And see, I actually go to IMDb, like I multiple times a week go to Rotten Tomatoes, IMDb, and Box Office Mojo. And
you totally do.
The Box Office Mojo one's the confusing one. That doesn't do me any good. I'm not in the industry. I don't make movies. I just watch them. Why do I care how much they made?
It's but just another form of social validation.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Yeah, see, okay, this is the thing. Social Network got 96% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. yeah, it was a very well-made movie is what it came down to, even if it was not...
Well, I loved... that's a great movie. I just love the ending of that movie, too.
Yeah.
Where they go through all this rigmarole, and she gets to the end and like, dude, you're just going to settle and move on. You're still going to be a billionaire. Whatever.
Yeah.
Just inconvenienced you for a day. And you're just like, wow, you know what? You're so right.
Yeah.
And then, this really isn't a big deal.
And for the record, Steve Jobs got an 86% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Really?
Despite being heavily maligned for being very inaccurate. But it was a well-made movie by a really good director. The Circle was trite. But you know what, James?
Happens.
We're not here to talk about movies. We're here this week, like every week, to talk about technology and the continuing corporate opera. And by that, we mean the soap opera of corporations, dealings back and forth, the people working for them, the cars they're driving, the cars that are driving them, their marketing campaigns, and of course, the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James got a short disclosure he wants to throw our way.
I work for a company that doesn't have any cars, isn't planning to make any cars, isn't planning to add any technology to cars, unless those parts are 3D printed.
What? I was going to say, what about printers?
You know, if there are cars out there with 3D printed parts, there's a high chance that HPI, the company I founded and work for, could participate in this next let's go with revolution. That sounds right. However, I do not represent HPI or any of their opinions or their market niches of choice.
It was, yeah, right.
if it were me, we would be in solar, but that's just me.
Yeah, well.
And let's see here. Oh, we're going to talk about, I also own part of Twitter, Etsy, and Lending Club, and I voted in the proxy vote for Etsy last week.
Nice.
Theirs was pretty boring, just electing board members.
Oh, man.
I confirmed them all. Just a yes man.
I know. Don't feel bad, though. You know who should feel bad about re-electing all of their board members? Freaking Wells Fargo. Like, what was that business? You're talking about...
What are you talking about? I don't...
Wells Fargo Bank.
I know the bank.
Yeah, but they've been like... So they were talking about completely firing all of their... Like, replacing the entire board because of all of the controversy with them, like, ripping people off and, like, huge fraud that the company is engaged. Have you not been following this story at all?
Nope.
Oh,
nope.
Dude. Yeah, Wells Fargo was like...
Sorry.
Wells Fargo did, like... Had like
they're my bank. What are we doing?
Yeah, man. Make sure you don't have any fake accounts taken out in your name, as they were doing like hundreds of thousands of like fake credit cards, like systemic practices within the company. They fired their CEO and clawed back his golden parachute, which never happens in the modern day. I mean, it's like a big deal.
Wow. I'm going to look this up later.
Put that on your reading list, man. That's, yeah.
Give me something to talk about with my mom-in-law since she works for them.
Yeah.
That should go over well.
Hmm.
Huh. Yeah. Anyway, so I own part of Twitter, Etsy, and Lending Club.
Yeah. Cool. Very cool. Very cool. If you want to follow us through the week, we're on the social internet. Facebook, probably. I mean, come on. Probably. Who's not? Twitter, my at Twitter is at Matthew D. Furlow. My Instagram, which is a Facebook property that is crushing Snapchat right now, is NextWiggin4.
Which is not your real name, by the way.
It is not. But the fact
you're
that
not a Wiggin. Obviously.
Wow. I hurt a little bit, actually. just digging it in there.
Beat you with the truth stick, I guess.
Yeah, that was... This episode's
gonna get real.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's see. I'm James Furlow. Twitter primarily. I mean, I'm on Facebook and LinkedIn and all the others, but
Who cares? Yeah, friend me on Facebook or on Facebook, sure, but I meant LinkedIn, which I was gonna say. I've been expanding my network on LinkedIn because I don't actually think that this has anything to do with it, other than the series of time. Like, I would get notifications on my LinkedIn app being like, you should go and check out LinkedIn and new friends. So I'd like hit the app, and then it would have me go through like 17 screens of like connect with this, connect with that, like give us all of your access. And I'd be like, no, stop it, I hate you. No, and I would just give up before I'd get to the main app where I could like connect with people. And I was so frustrated with one day, I actually tweeted at Insta, at LinkedIn, like, I hate your app and how many I just hate it. And like, I thought I was just like announcing into the void.
Right.
But I have my Twitter linked to Facebook and got like a dozen likes, which is a pretty good post for me. And LinkedIn responded, were like, we're really sorry about that. And then the next time I opened the app, there was none. Now, I don't think they can like go in and just like switch that on and off. I doubt that they can like manually do that. But I'm just saying, there it was pretty convenient timing. And I don't know.
Dude, I know that totally. You're an influencer.
Yeah.
They saw your likes on Facebook and went, oh man, we got to pay attention to this guy.
12 likes. That's so many likes.
Man. It's all the quality of the likes.
Exactly. It's the cascading effect. My network, their network, you know. But anyways.
Super good. Super good. All right, I want to talk about Robinhood first and foremost, who is the company who we regularly advertise for, even though they do not pay us to do it.
So it makes you wonder.
It's all right. It's all good. They're the free stock trading app. If you haven't downloaded it, you should. And we're starting to get to the point where if you haven't, you're going to be in the minority, to be honest. They are growing like a weed.
That's awesome.
I guess I'm going to... I just left something out of the room. That's okay. Yeah, so they're growing crazy. It's like, what did they say? It was 144,000 people join every month or something like that. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's more than two people. So it's super sweet because it's free trading. And it's funny, they were talking about, why we're talking about them is they've reached the Unicorn Club. They are now valued over $1 billion. Yay! And
that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, they've got 2 million total users, and they just raised $100 million to help them grow like crazy. I get they have 80 people working for them. That's ridiculous. So they were the classic startup where for a while, it's 140 accounts per month. There we go. I finally found the number. They're a classic startup where for a long time people were like, yeah, but if you don't charge any money for trades, how will you make money?
I feel like we solved that one early on.
Yeah, we did. Well, and they were like, well, the big one is your money isn't invested at all times and it's sitting in a checking account and we keep the interest.
Yeah.
And they're like, honestly, as the Fed raises rates, our business gets better.
Right. Yeah.
But you're like, oh, that's kind of crazy. But then they came out with something called, I'm going to get it right. I got to open up my app because it's like the gold box or something like that. It's Robinhood Gold, where essentially you pay a fee. It might be like $6 to $15 per month, depends on your size and other stuff like that. And there is a $200 a month option. But with that $200 a month option, you can borrow up to $50,000 to trade on. So that's part of what it is. It allows you to trade on margin. In other words, you don't have to have all the money in the account to make the trade, which could be nice. And you get to skip the 3-day waiting period for deposits to make trades instantly. So like right now, if I were to sell a stock on Robinhood, they would sell it and then it would take 3 days for my money to be available again to spend in the account. So I can't, like if something happened today, I could not take advantage of it.
Okay.
By selling another stock and then buying it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But if you get in the gold, Boom. You're on.
Lord. Go for it. Man.
Sweet. The trades are still free. You're just paying a monthly subscription cost. And so that was where all of a sudden they said their conversations went from we want to see where the revenue is going to, whoa, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And I thought this was actually super interesting too. And just, oh, I don't know, smart people. So they've come up with something that they're calling, I think the article's calling it referral hood. It's this referral program. This is super interesting. So they want to kind of want to go viral and want to grow and things like that. And again, in the Friendster podcast I was listening to, one of the things they were talking about is figuring out what are your metrics of success. How do you grow? How do you go viral? How do you get sticky? And they said the thing that Facebook figured out was you have to make 7 friend connections in 10 days. If you do that, we got you.
Yeah.
And so what they figured out was the big sticking point why people don't get started is they don't know which stock to buy. So when you refer someone else and they sign up, he goes, you both get one share of a randomly selected company, which, by the way, includes Facebook, Apple, Rite Aid, Ford, General Electric, some others. And there's thing is they say most people who don't invest in the stock market, their biggest hangup is they just don't know which stock to buy the very first time. And so they make that decision
for you.
Do
it for you. Nice.
And just go, here, you got a stock. Boom, done. You can sell it, take the cash. That's cool. I'm like, you buy a stock of Apple for people? Are you kidding me?
I'm sure they don't do that very often.
Yeah. I would have been like, we're hanging out in the penny stock.
Yeah.
We'll give you something. But
yeah. Apple's at $143. But it's a stock,
right?
Jeez Louise, they're worth a lot of money.
Yeah, maybe like I'll take a Google stock or an Amazon, perhaps.
Right, yeah. What's the Amazon? Oh my gosh.
They're on the race to 1,000 right now with Google.
Googs is at 906.
And yeah, Amazon's like 950.
Amazon, yeah. Jeez.
Yeah, crazy. But I was just like, just a very cool idea.
Guess what Skullcandy's at? I still have it. So when you go to the main page.
Oh, you opened the app.
I did. I finally did. I saw what happened, and I just have money in my account. So evidently they just sold the stock for me. Thanks, guys.
Oh, you're welcome.
You know what? I deserve it. Yeah, but so how their app works, if you've never used it before, and you should, is on your main splash page, you can like select the stocks you want to follow. So I got a bunch of tech companies, including Skullcandy, which I bought once. But because Skullcandy is no longer a publicly traded company, it's just a blank slot. There's no information in it.
Huh.
That's kind of cool. I don't want to get rid of that now because I'm sure that's kind of a unique thing to have for users. I should reinvest my money, James. Who can I spend $50 on?
Etsy.
Yeah. Intel Corporation. That's probably not a good buy.
Snapchat. What are they printing? Ah, 22.
Man, I almost want to.
Tesla's at, oh, never mind, 315. What's HP at? $18.
Ooh.
You could have similar disclosures as me. That'd be so funny.
Prominent stock shareholder.
Matthew is my owner.
Oh, man. It's good times.
Love buying stock. But anyways, yeah, super cool. Congratulations, Robin Hood. We still love you.
Yeah.
We'll advertise for you anytime.
Especially if you pay us, which you won't. But yeah, you know, it's cool.
We're here for you. The other one that I wanted to talk about before we get into our the real driving story this week. Yeah. So Pinterest came out with this new button, I guess, for lack of a better word, feature.
Okay.
That actually sounds pretty stinking sweet. And I think would solve a bunch of problems or issues. Like it's like this roundabout way of solving like the fake news issue while keeping it ultra, ultra sticky. So,
okay,
all it is, well, they call it instant ideas button, but essentially it's a show me more like this button. So when you look on their particular feed, there's just a little circle. And when you tap the circle, what it does, so like you got your feed and all your items on it. When you tap the circle, it just inserts like six or so, maybe six or eight more pins, I guess, that are like the one that you saw. And then it moves your existing ones down a little bit. And if you want more than six, you just kind of keep clicking and it'll keep adding like six more as you go. So the idea being that it's all done in line. And when you're done, it's not, you're not saying I only want, like, what is this? It's an epic grilled cheese recipes. Okay.
Okay.
Like if you clicked on that, it then would give you more grilled cheese recipes. But the problem with most things, and we've seen this on like side of Facebook and stuff, is when you do just like give me stories like this, it brings you over to just that particular topic.
Okay.
And after a while, you're like, dude, I just wanted a couple more. I didn't want like a lot more. So the idea being like after you finish that six, you're back to your regular feed of diverse content. And so you can imagine something on Facebook where, or Twitter perhaps, right? Where you like this and you say, show me more. And maybe it'll show you more of that particular hashtag or from that user or that topic or something. And, you know, there's various ways to, you know, to totally handle that. But then once you're done with that a half dozen posts, it goes back to your regular feed.
Nice.
And back into it. Yeah, it just kind of, you know, just shoves everything down and then keeps going. Now, I think this where this could take a really cool turn is where everyone's all freaked out about the fake news. What if on, like, say, Facebook or Twitter, instead of it was like, instead of the show more like this, it might have also be, in addition to that, they set it up so it will show you the other side. It's,
interesting.
Behind this. It's the same topic. It's just now we're giving you a different angle.
Different perspective.
Different perspective. Thank you. And so it's a very cool idea that Pinterest is pioneering. And as this writer wrote, Josh Constein, it's probably Constein. He's like, everyone should copy this now. And I agree. I think it's a cool idea, a way to just kind of keep things going.
Well, trust me, if it works, Facebook will copy it.
That was, what is his opening? This is the best new social app feature in a long time. Twitter should copy it. Instagram should copy it. Facebook probably already is copying it. yes, we all know you, Facebook.
Well, they're going to turn it into a platform though.
yeah, they do. Oh, jeez. Yeah, they do.
Oh man.
Super funny. But anyways, just thought it was a good feature. Worth sharing. If you're on Pinterest, you should check it out. But
that's very Pinteresting, James.
Pinteresting.
That hurt. Oh, that's cool. I like that. So we're gonna click on the more like this button about transportation today.
Okay.
Holy cow. I do not know what happened, but there was a confluence news of events that all sort of piled into a big topic, and it spreads the gamut. We're not even going to cover it all because there's not enough time, James. We're just going to hit the big ones. But we'll start out with the Tesla. Tesla, obviously, they're making their Model 3. And
yeah, they are.
They're gearing up for production. They bought a German automation company. We've talked about it briefly, and that they were hired so that they could focus on building all the tooling up for the Model 3s and to get ready for it. And there's two related stories here, and we'll start out with the dramatic one. So the dude that like started the company, named after, that owned the company, they sold it to Tesla, and he basically came on as the guy who ran that now subsidiary of Tesla. And Elon Musk was like, I want you to automate our manufacturing process. And the dude was like, yeah, no problem. Problem is that there was a problem. He turns out the company got their name and their experience doing automated manufacturing for BMW and Mercedes back in Germany. And those clients really valued them. And the owner wanted to, what's his name? Graham Engineering, Klaus Graham, which is an amazingly German name, said, hey, we want to keep supporting those tools, keep supporting those companies. And Musk was like, no. We bought you. You're Tesla now. Like, you don't get to do that. So they had a bit of a kerfluffle.
How was that not obvious from the beginning?
I don't know. Yeah, but Klaus Graham is now he's updated his LinkedIn resume. He's looking
made a couple
for
new connections.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
wow.
Definitely.
How do you miss that?
I don't even know. Yeah, that seems like one of those, like, you guys didn't work that out before the whole thing started. We'll work that minor detail out later. All your other customers that, like, from your home country that you love and respect, yeah, no, they're not your customers anymore. Tesla's your
only
customer.
The enemy.
Yeah. It was only 6 months ago that Tesla acquired Graham Engineering, with the firm's founder agreeing to head a new division with the automaker called Tesla Advanced Automation Germany. Acquisition was the linchpin of Tesla's plan to add an additional 1,000 engineers and technician jobs in Germany on top of Graham's existing 700 employees over the next 2 years. This was to happen in parallel with the company's aggressive plan to ramp up electrical vehicle production in Fremont, California factory. Tesla has stated its goal to produce 500,000 vehicles by 2018. Yeah. At the time, Tesla said Graham would continue to work with its outside clients, including those in the automotive industry. But over time, those directives apparently changed, leading to Graham's ousting. Yeah. Kind of a bummer, man.
Wow.
Kind of a bummer. But this is the thing. Tesla needs the focus. They need the attention. They need the undivided efforts, because
I agree.
They're taking a bit of a
I think Elon is right.
Yeah.
In this situation.
Definitely. Well, they've got an enormous, like, this is an enormous next step. They're getting ready to manufacture 500,000 cars. They've never produced cars on that scale. And this could destroy Tesla if it doesn't go well. And they're taking kind of a big risk. I actually don't think it's that big of a risk in the modern world, which is the reason they're taking it. But in automotive manufacturing, it is not only is it common, but it's pretty much generally accepted the only way that you would tool up for a new line of cars is to build what they call soft tools. And soft tools are tools that are very expensive because they are reconfigurable. They're either easier to program. They've got they can switch out different tools and stuff. And in automotive manufacturing, we've all seen the commercials where the arms go through and do the exact same repetition again and again and again and again.
Yeah.
But sometimes it takes people a couple of tries to get that right. You know, how do we design these tools so that they only have to do one task and they have to do it excellently. But it sometimes can take quite a bit of engineering and practice to figure out what that one task is and how to do it excellently. So the solution is this soft tooling. So you develop a pilot production line, and for a new car, whatever you're going to build, your 2008 model electric vehicle is a BMW, for example. And you tool up for it, you build all the stuff, and then you start producing small quantities of it. And once you're very happy with the outcome of the cars that you're getting, then you look at the configurations you have, you look at the software, the hardware, whatever, and then you build another line. And the second manufacturing line that you build is more like hard tools, I guess, is what you would describe them as. And those hard tools are fixed. When you build them, they do the one task again and again and again. And most companies would never build the hard tools first, because if you get it wrong, they're more expensive. They're designed to handle manufacturing at full scale. Well, Tesla announced that they're going to save a bunch of money by skipping the soft tooling step. And yeah, it's being viewed as being.
So that's sounds dumb.
Yeah, it's being viewed as super risky. And I just think it's an
example. It's like on, was that The Martian? We're like, how long does it take to do those safety checks? How often do they result in something? Let's skip them. And then the rocket blows up.
Yes. That's
the fear.
That's the fear. Well, and the thing is it is the fear, but I also have a feeling that this is a classic example of Elon Musk sort of disrupting in the best way that he can. Because I feel like the whole idea of soft tooling is something that was a necessity in 1980s when the first, you know, the earliest of automation was happening. And then it's clear through the 90s. That was a huge investment, and it was a separate investment. And then in the early 2000s, it probably started to tip in the favor of it wasn't fully necessary. You could really design the production line in a virtual world with a high level of confidence, and you could build in, without adding very much cost, a lot of flexibility to the production line. But at that point, there was still some risk. It wasn't a slam dunk. And the big car companies were like, just no, make it perfect. Make it safe. Like, play by the rules. And the rules have been established. And Elon Musk, in his inimitable style, has been like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, you can, like, it's the reason why computers are amazing is because of their flexibility. They're not purpose-built tools. These automation tools don't have to be purpose-built. You can build the flexibility into full-scale production now without adding to cost, or B, adding very little to cost, and just plan better. We can plan better. That's the advantage of all of these crazy, you know, simulations that we've got. We don't have to, we don't have to build it first and then, and hope it works and see what the outcome is. No, we can simulate it. We can. Now, he could be wrong. Nobody's ever done this before. That's obviously the concern, is nobody's ever tried this before.
Look, he can land a rocket on a moving platform. He can figure this out.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. And now it actually makes all the more sense why they bought this automation company, because they're like, look, over the course of 30 years, this is the way that we want to go forward with new generations of cars. Bring on the people so that we can do this. Let's stop these ridiculous, crazy things. And it also makes more sense why they're willing to make kind of bolder statements about, you know, we're going to turn on the manufacturing to scale to build this many cars, and we can do it, where a lot of the financial people are saying, oh, this is incredibly risky to take on this many pre-orders that quickly, because how can you scale it up? If you look at it through the prism of how a traditional car company would do it, it doesn't make sense. If you look at it through the prism of how Musk wants to do it, you're like, oh yeah, no, totally. That's very doable. And yeah, I think
this, you kind of get that same sense where he's like, yeah, we're going to go to Mars for, what is it, a tenth of the cost and a tenth of the time. A tenth of the energy or whatever it is. And you're like, whoa, wait. And then he goes, we'll just reuse the rockets. And you go, oh,
right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you didn't say that.
Because everybody was sitting there going, well, you can't possibly do that. Rockets are too expensive. You can't. What are you saying? And he's like, no, we'll just, yeah, exactly. And then he makes
the same idea.
Then he makes his airplane analogy. And you're like, oh, yeah, that's kind of cool.
Doing that. Man, he thinks about the world differently.
He does. And the other cool part about it is they're putting another 500,000 cars on the road in the next, 13 days or whatever short time period they're dealing with. So they've got another problem. They've built out their charge stations, but what if there's, you know, four times as many Teslas on the road all of a sudden?
That would be pretty lame to roll up to a charging station and have to wait in line.
Yes, that would be very lame. So they're trying to cut that off the pass, and they are vastly expanding their supercharged sites for more travel refueling spots. really got a nice mock-up where it's like a, it's in a parking lot. They got like a little Tesla store where you can go in and buy stuff. And then they got like a, an entire, you know, place with all the charging stations and solar panels above it. Quite the vertical integration thing they've got going on. Tesla's working hard to make it easier for customers to charge their electric cars. It doubled down on the claim this morning with the announcement that it'll have 10,000 superchargers available by the end of 2017. Additionally, Tesla is planning to build larger supercharge sites to fit several dozen cars, and it's increasing the amount of destination charging locations for slower refueling to 15,000 globally, up from 9,000 last year.
Wow, that's a big growth.
Yeah, it's particularly impressive since it took the company 5 years to build 5,400 chargers. So yeah, it's quite the massive growth of charge sites, but you know, I don't have much of a choice here. Hopefully, I think one of the big hopes is that,
oh boy, I think I lost you again. My internet has been suffering lately, and I've been told that I need to get a new router or modem or something. Apparently, a modem is only meant to last a couple of years, so that's great. Tell you what, we're going to take a little bit of a break, and we will be right back. And we're back. All right, we were just talking about Tesla's charging stations, and you had one more point that you wanted to make about them.
Yeah, so the last point was that they open sourced all the patents on how to like for the chargers a while back, and the logic being there that if you get sufficient demand for these, third parties will start building supercharged stations. When
that makes sense,
nobody knows. Well, yeah, it does. Hopefully, because if it doesn't work, man, kind of a bummer. But
yeah,
it's a huge expansion for Tesla, and
that's exciting.
It is exciting. It's very exciting.
They're going for the win.
Yes,
appreciate that.
But that wasn't the only thing that happened this week. We're not even going to talk about the Born Company, which turns out is actually happening. They showed a picture,
of the video
of the boring tool, which is hilarious.
Yeah, which I loved. Oh, who was it? It was TechCrunch had a great title for it. It was "Man Who Owns a Car Company Thinks We Should Build a Public Transportation System for Cars." And you're like, that's a great yeah. That is the way he sees it.
Well,
and it's like, this is the dumbest thing ever. Like, build an underground like normal.
Yeah. Yeah. I see where Tesla's coming for Tesla. I see where Musk is coming from. He's like, there's a lot of these sorts of tools that were developed 50 years ago that nobody's really rethought through. And if we just think through it, you might find that there are modern ways to think about how to engineer stuff like a boring tool and completely reinvent it and dramatically reduce costs and make it possible to create vast, ridiculous networks of virtually like, right now, we only bore, or I didn't want to talk about it. Right now, you only bore tunnels when you, like, when it's the only option, because it's so much more expensive to bore a tunnel than it is to build a bridge or to build a road or whatever. And if you could flip those economics upside down, if you could make it cheaper to just dig deeper and bore a tunnel than it is to build a bridge, that would completely change how we build infrastructure.
Makes sense. And
Tesla and Musk is basically saying, look, nobody's even tried to reinvent boring in the last 50 years. Let me take a look at it. Let's see. I'm just gonna build one tunnel underneath the SpaceX parking lot just to see. let's get crazy here. Discover something interesting. So yeah, I don't know. It's kind of cool. But that's not what we're talking about today, James. We're talking about real things that are really happening. So Apple is putting a bunch of their senior engineers in the driving seat of self-driving cars. They announced this week, it's starting to come out who those people are. They've got a bunch of, this is paywalled.
Wall Street Journal.
I know.
for.
It's who funny. It's a mystery. I clicked on that. It's funny. I got the link from a website that just copies and pastes the pertinent information into their link. And then I always grab the original source. And
the original.
I shouldn't have for the Wall Street Journal. Anyways, the point is they've hired a bunch of NASA engineers, JPL, the Jet Propulsion Labs engineers from, yeah.
Are we making flying cars?
Kind of. We'll get there, James. Hold on to your butts. But no, they're doing self-driving cars. And they got the California DMV just a week or two ago gave them a permit to test out self-driving cars on the streets in California. So we're starting to get more information about what Apple is doing, just the very beginnings of it. But one of the big things is they hired a bunch of NASA experts, and when you register with the DMV to test cars, self-driving cars, you have to tell them who the drivers are. You're permitting the people who are going to be sitting behind the wheel. Okay. And unlike a lot of other companies, Google and Uber specifically, like Apple's putting some of their most senior engineers behind the wheel to be like, yeah, we want to be on the roads and be checking it out. And nobody seems specifically sure why they're doing it other than Apple's clearly taking it pretty seriously. We want to get on the roads with these things. And, you know, I don't know about you, but NASA has a pretty good reputation for stellar engineers. So I don't know. It's an interesting move because it nobody really knows what it means. nobody's exactly clear other than the fact that they're doing it. This does make me feel good to a degree because, if you remember back when all of this news broke, this was, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, the very first rumblings of Apple's building a car. And that at the time I said, of course, Apple is building a car. They're never going to sell a car, but they'll build cars because they want to ask the question, you know, what goes into building. They build prototypes of everything. They're building prototypes of cars because they want to do the brains inside the car, and they wanted to figure out the dimensions of that. And the project, the Titan or project, whatever they're calling it, it's already taken that major step where they're like, they've abandoned building the hardware and they're now modifying cars and putting them on the roads. And this week we got to find out what those cars will look like. Somebody who may or may not be working for Apple. We don't actually know that they're working for Apple. It just seems pretty convenient that Apple is in this, you know, trying to push the bounds of what their car company is all about. And thankfully somebody caught them on the roads, but Apple's using the Lexus RX 450 H SUV for its autonomous vehicle testing program as revealed by documents filed with the California DMV in accordance with the licensing, blah, 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 blah. Now Bloomberg has images of the vehicle in action captured by a chance observer. Sure. Who saw the vehicle pull out of the Apple facilities. They just happened to be there right at the right time. They weren't an employee that was told, hey, go across the street, take a video of this and send it to Bloomberg. The SUV looks pretty much similar to test cars used by Waymo, the former Google self-driving car company, whose headquarters are pretty much just down the road from Apple's Cupertino headquarters. Judging by these spy shots and the information found in the DMV documents made public, Apple is very early in the autonomous technology program compared to companies like Waymo. So, yeah, I mean, it looks exactly like any other self-driving car. They've got, like, extra bulges and sensors on them. They've got cameras. They've got the LiDAR on top of the car as they drive around. So, yeah, Apple's getting their self-driving.
Dude, we're going to have self-driving cars. This is so awesome.
Autonomous vehicles.
I was talking with my wife, Jessie, that's her name. And I was like, you know, at some point in time, we're going to end up spending gobs of money, and it will either be on an airplane or on a self-driving car.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, I don't know which one yet, but just prepare your heart and mind that eventually I'm going to say, you know, we should really spend like $300,000 on this.
Just so you know, Jane, this week's not over, and the question's only going to get more difficult as this show goes on.
Oh, man, I'm excited. I'll tell you this, though. My heart says I want the airplane. But I take a car that flies over the boat.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Like that's a good hybrid. But I'm also just like, man, a self-driving car.
I know. I just
both. Oh, that seems greedy.
There has been so much going on, and it's fascinating to me because it's like I was driving from Chico, California, this afternoon, and it's a bit of a slog. But we were, you know, I found myself thinking a lot about self-driving cars as we're making this drive, and. Just like what it would be like if I didn't have to drive, if I could be sitting there and reading or preparing or doing work on this 4-hour journey that we're on. But also you get into like the whole, you hit a traffic jam, and just one of those traffic jams are really fascinating because they're a mechanic of like, once you get to a certain particular density of cars, they're virtually inevitable. And they always show up in the same places for really just, usually they're like turns. They're like mystery traffic jams that don't make any sense. We're like, what? Why did we all slow down here? What happened? What's going on? It is a function of the fact that as drivers, even the best drivers have imperfect knowledge of the situation. So you are forced to make certain decisions as a driver that lead to traffic. And it's a function of car density. And what's really cool is they've done big studies and they've shown that if you have, even if it's just a 10th of the cars, one out of every 10 cars is connected and knows about traffic jams and what's causing it, they can take maneuvers that will affect the entire flow of traffic, all 100% of the cars, and they can break up traffic jams. Like there's such cool different mechanics. Whoa. That you can, and it's just what they do.
It's like some sort of like hive fluid dynamics.
It is. It's
craziness.
Basically, what you have to do is you have to slow down cars before you hit the traffic jam, which reduces the car density at the jam, allowing it to free up. And then, if you know how big the jam is and how far back you have to slow it down, you can judge these things appropriately. But you have to know ahead of time that you need to do that and at what rate. That's what's so cool about this is it's just the fact that all these different companies are going to be able to get on the road together. You're going to have these really, really beneficial, like people are going to electively jump into these. There's going to be a lot of people that are like, I don't want a self-driving car. And I'll be like, fine. Yeah. We don't need you to need one. That's so cool. And, you know, Apple, I don't know what Apple's end game is on this. You know, obviously, they're spending quite a bit of money trying to figure out the car thing. So they think that there's something there. And as far ahead, even though it seems a company like Waymo is way further ahead of everybody else, clearly they've decided that they're not far enough ahead to not give it a go. And so they're going to try to build the software out and look into it. Oh, that's exciting.
Makes sense.
But you want to know the company that seems to be winning the most from the self-driving car revolution?
Uber.
No. No. Weirdly enough, it seems to be Toyota. For reasons that are
Toyota
that are sort of hard to explain, the Lexus RX turns out to be like the perfect car for modifying.
Is Lexus a Toyota?
Yeah, Lexus is a Toyota company.
I didn't know that. Huh. I didn't know who else they would be, but okay.
Yeah. They're Toyota back in the 80s decided they wanted to compete against BMW and Mercedes in the luxury car market.
Yeah.
And their strategy was basically like BMW and Mercedes, their entire business model is built around reputation. you pay that much.
So they created a sub brand.
Exactly.
Like Dockers. Levi did with Dockers.
Exactly. And so what they did was they created a sub brand, and then they did something even more clever, was they're like, look, the Toyota car company makes a ton of money, and we realize we have to build up the brand of a stellar car. So they sold Lexuses under cost for like a decade while they built up a driver base in America before they started finally raising the prices to be more in line with the other luxury car brands. But that's actually how they built up the luxury. That's how Toyota broke into the luxury market. That is only passing.
The Lexus always seemed less pretentious than the Mercedes to me.
Yeah, and honestly, a lot of that comes down to, I think, the fact that now knowing their history, it's the fact that it was a cheaper car. You know, and part of the
thing about my best friend from school, his dad owned a Lexus, and he's the kind of guy where he would pay attention to that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's funny. My boss is a huge Lexus guy. It's a nice car, it really is. But
I mean, I'm more of a Jaguar fan myself.
Jaguar.
But if it flies, I don't care what the brand is.
Yeah, me personally, James.
I'm a little the same way with an automated driving car. You know, brand, I'm not as concerned about that, which is probably your point here.
Straight up, Rolls-Royce is my choice.
All right, heavy spender.
Look, if we're gonna get crazy about spending our money, James, if we're throwing around $300,000, I'm picking a Rolls, okay?
I don't think you need $300,000 for a Jag. I feel like 90 will get you what you want.
Probably.
But if it doesn't self-drive, I'm going to have trouble justifying one.
Yeah. We were making fun of...
Oh, I can't believe I just said that out loud.
Oh, man. We were joking about the fact that I have a friend who works for BMW, and his part, he gets in on the lease program, where they make it cheaper for employees to have BMWs. But Rolls-Royce is a partner subsidiary. That, I don't actually know what the relationship
really?
Is. Yeah, but BMW and Rolls-Royce are the same company. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I was like, oh man, if I was him and I had access to that like program, that if it was even on the table, I don't even care if they're like $500 a month for your employee discounted thing on a Rolls. I'm getting a Rolls. I'm driving a Rolls everywhere. And our cousin, I'm going to be probably moving in with him in the next couple of months. He's like, it's crazy.
Is your roommate getting married or something?
Or something, specifically. They want to have a honeymoon sort of thing, which whatever.
Ridiculous.
I know. But I'm moving out with – it's a good thing I've got so many cousins, because I'm moving out of living with one cousin to move in with another cousin. But he was making fun of me. He's like, dude, you are the one that you're like the cheapest out of all of us. You want to live in like the worst neighborhoods just so you can save like $50 a month on rent. And you're looking at a Rolls. I was like, that's so I can afford a Rolls, man.
Look, I was talking about this earlier today with Jesse as well. We were on a walk and I was like, because we were making some other friends for decisions. Like they buy nice clothes.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And I'm just like, that's just is not me. Like, I'm cool with the Walmart. Give me the cheap stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not quite like Jessie. Now she's cheap. She's like Goodwill.
Oh, that's.
And I'm just like, it's already been worn once. But anyways, but I'm super cheap with clothes to the point where I don't buy quality clothes and they just get worn and then I don't refresh them and I just look like I've worn clothes. But anyways, but when it comes to tech stuff, I'll spend stupid amounts of money in order to do it. I'm like, you look at my house. I've invested way more into it. Like I recently put in a dimmer switch into one of the rooms. And no, I did not buy the little $3 pole dimmer switch. I bought the awesome one.
Right, yeah. And, it doesn't talk to your phone. It doesn't belong in this house.
Exactly. Actually, this one doesn't, because I thought that would be weird in the bathroom. And so I opted not for that, for hopefully obvious reasons. But I considered it, and had it made sense, I would have done it. But anyways, my point being that there are certain things. So here's like the healthy way to do it is you decide what's important to you. What are your priorities? What do you like? lavishly spend on that. Don't skimp. Fully enjoy him. But then for everything else, ruthlessly cut. And that's okay.
Yeah.
And for you, you could say, you know what? Where I lay my head at night, not important, so I'm going to go cheap. I like hanging out with friends. That's important to me, so I'm going to spend money on that.
Exactly. And to me, it's like...
So I'm with you. That's healthy.
You know what? Thank you. That's where I'm at. And that's why I'm going to buy a Rolls Royce.
Yes. Oh. And if there's an automated driving car or a flying car, I'm probably going to buy one of those. And I'm going to spend too much money. And people are going to go, what is wrong with him?
Probably.
Like, dude, let me take you for a ride. And then you'll see how awesome I am. It's funny where this is only half related. So we need to get a van. It's sad. Because we have kids now. We're borrowing a friend's van.
Okay.
right now, we're doing a day trip and tomorrow. And so we have the van right now. And so we swapped with him and we swapped the Prius.
Okay.
And he's just like, whoa, this is weird. Like, I turn it on and there's no noise. That's right. That's right. So I'm like, if people are impressed with the Prius.
Yeah.
I cannot wait.
Yeah, it's yeah. I hear you.
There's times I turn it on too and just go, "Dude, this is kind of cool." Yeah. Still doesn't get old. So Toyota, speaking of the Prius, they're making the Lexus. And
yes,
I think what you're about to tell
me. Yeah, so this is kind of cool. So the extent of Lexus's popularity among those conducting self-driving experiments is pretty amazing. Not only is Apple using the luxury car brand as a platform to test its software, but so are many other operators. It's essentially free advertising for Lexus's parent company, Toyota. Lexus may be the most high-profile brand on the road, but there are others. There are other makes and models used for self-driving tests by companies playing in the space, including the Ford Fusion, who is being used by Uber, who is partnering with Ford, Udacity, who is partnering with Ford, and unsurprisingly, Ford. and then the Lincoln MKZ being used by Faraday Future, which isn't a real company, and Drive.ai, which is a real company. They're just not really doing anything impressive. Volvo's safety record makes a popular choice. What goes into the decision-making process for choosing a self-driving test car? Battery capacity, cargo space, all-wheel drive are just some of the considerations made by self-driving operators.
That makes sense.
According to Sam Obzulmaid, sorry, got your now name wrong, Sam. Senior analyst at Navigant, the higher the autonomy of the vehicle, the more electricity required to power the car's self-driving hardware. Totally makes sense. A conventional internal combustion engine vehicle with a 12-volt electrical system only offers about 12.5 kilowatts of electrical power max, and on modern cars, they're close to maxed out. Highly autonomous vehicles, level 4 and up, will probably require 48-volt systems. And brand familiarity is another driving factor. Both the Lexus RX and the Ford Fusion have been around. Yeah, so, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, it's just interesting that, yeah, you get this one car that kind of was like the best pick for Google, basically, is what it comes down to. Is Google was the first people to put out cars that were self-driving. This is the one they picked, and kind of everybody's going with it, unless Ford is telling them, don't. Don't you dare use a Lexus. You're our partner. and yeah, so it's pretty good spot for Toyota being like, yeah, it was, that's us. We're doing that. Pretty cool. And then, Waymo also made a very big announcement this week.
Yeah, it was huge.
Yeah,
I thought at least.
Yeah, I've thought about it more, and I don't really know. I have questions.
When are you moving to Arizona?
Right. Exactly.
Is that where you and your new roommate are looking?
Yes. Alphabet's legal battle with blah blah blah. That's stupid. Basically, they're opening up a pilot program in Phoenix, Arizona. Allowing families to register for its early ride program. Over the course of this trial, we'll be accepting hundreds of people with diverse backgrounds and transportation needs who want to ride in and give feedback about Waymo self-driving cars.
rather than offering people one or two rides, the goal of this program is to give participants access to the fleet every day at any time to go anywhere within an area that's about twice the size of San Francisco. So basically what they're doing is they're opening up a taxi program that will allow, that's of all the Waymo cars. It occurred to me at some point that they put together this pretty cool promo video of a family being like, "It's the future. This is how it's going to be going. It's so cool." And all of a sudden, I realized, like days later, that there's obviously a Google employee sitting in the driver's seat, right? I mean,
yep.
Okay,
there is.
All right, that makes me feel better. But yeah, they partnered with Chrysler earlier this year, and basically said, "Hey, these are our new cars. They're specifically designed for this autonomous driving." Nobody really knew what the point of that was, other than it allowed them more expandability to build more cars quickly. This is clearly where they were heading with it. Got the 100 autonomous Chrysler Pacifica hybrid minivans, but the number will rise to 600 in the coming months. The idea is to see where people want to go, but also to monitor how families interact with the car and assess the features they'd like to see inside of them. So, yeah, it's Goog is doing the thing.
It's happening.
They're starting the very nascent beginnings of an actual network of self-driving cars. They're looking over at Uber and saying, "See, this is how you do it."
It just makes so much sense too. I love this idea of you apply and you're in.
Yeah.
You know, and that allows them to grow at a rate that works. That makes sense.
Well, and it allows you to see, cause we all talk about this hypothetical, what would you do if you didn't have to think about your car, right? It's like, would a world be like where there was always enough self-driving cars? And so they're basically, Uber was putting, you know, these cars on the road so they could test them out and saying, well, that's what Uber is it's this car that can go anywhere all the time for you and it'll replace all your rides. But it's not really that. Whereas this is that. They're saying, we're going to run the experiment really and truly. What would it be like if a car that you need is always around the corner and will go do its own thing while you're not around, but it'll come back and pick you up and then continue on its way? How would you use it? And which is an interesting question. It really is. And it's exciting to see them kind of moving down this road. We've talked about, we predicted last year that Waymo needed to do a large public demonstration of it, of their technology. And we came up with some pretty clever but unused suggestions. but this is a pretty good one. This is good. And obviously the best.
Now their little intro video was super dumb, but I'm hoping that through this, that'll help with some of that marketing stuff too.
Not
good stories.
It was not the worst promo video that a Larry Page company came up with this week. In all fairness, but it's just a family being like, yeah, we're using the car. It's going to be awesome.
Well, they were going around like introducing other names and the last kid goes and they all like laugh at him.
Yeah.
I'm like, why was that funny? Did I miss the joke? Is that not his name?
Yeah. Right. He's funny. I noticed that too. I was like, oh, this is kind of weird. But
I'm so embarrassed. We're on camera.
Yeah, pretty much. I think that's what they were trying to get at.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so the biggest problem that I see with this program is that there's not a chance that if I lived there, I would be accepted to it. Because I am not, how did they describe it? I am not part of the group of people described as hundreds of people with it. Diverse backgrounds and transportation needs. I don't think I'm in their target demo of, because I think what they're looking for is just regular old families, because this offers them, one, they're running an experiment and they want to see what does it look like to have this fully autonomous fleet? How would people use it? But the other one, and I think this is the more important one, is this is their new advertising campaign. they want hundreds of families who can be their advocates, that can be, that can go on news media and be interviewed about it eventually. They want parents who say, oh yeah, I let the car, I let my kid get driven all over the place without me in the car because I trust the car. Like, that's what Google wants. And it's a very clever advertising, you know, mechanism for them. And, you know, unsurprisingly, they went to Phoenix, Arizona, where there's so rarely inclement weather that they'll never run into any of those problems. Surprised they didn't pick San Diego.
Yeah.
but
too much traffic.
Yeah, that's a good point. So I don't know. Pretty clever. And then as much as that's the near future of transportation, James, it got real late in the week because turns out flying cars became a thing. Mark your calendars. 30th of April.
Oh, yes.
Larry Page started a secret company like 3 years ago who is going to develop a self or a flying car. And they introduced their first car. And you obviously have not seen this promo video. It is worth a gander. Introducing the Kitty Hawk Flyer. It's so dumb. This video.
Okay, I'm watching it. I might be watching an ad right now.
Yeah, almost.
I'm watching a Delta ad that I can't skip. It's an entire minute long ad that I can't skip. Are you
not worth watching the video then? So they are
continuing.
Yeah, sorry. So they're talking about the Kitty Hawk Flyer. Is this new video? It's the first aircraft from the Larry Page backed Kitty Hawk, a startup taking aim at creating real usable flying cars. And basically what this is a multi-rotor quadcopter that you sit on. It's kind of like looks like a jet ski with like eight rotors on the edges of it. It's got
that sounds safe.
You're right. It's got, what are those called? They're not water skis, but like your plane has them so you can land on water. Pontoons. There we go. So it's got,
so it goes on water?
It is.
Hold on. Someone's pouring a drink.
It is the least.
Someone's talking on a phone.
Flying. And you're missing the best parts because they're like, you should come over. And they'll be like, I'll be there in 5 minutes. And they're like, it's going to take you at least 20 minutes to take your boat across our private lake. And the woman's like, don't worry. I have a surprise. She's like, but how are you going to get here so quickly? And she's like, don't worry. You're going to love this surprise. And then all of a sudden, she's flying her. Flying car. I'm using my finger quotes.
Whoa, look at that thing.
Yeah, it's a personal autonomous vehicle. Pretty cool. It's pretty cool looking, I guess, kind of. Yes, it sits on water. It lands and takes off on water. It can fly you from one private dock to another private dock, evidently.
Well, this is a rich person's toy, huh?
Oh, quite the rich person's toy. While you can't yet order the flyer, you can pay a one-time fee of $100 to become a, quote, flyer discovery member, which will provide access to Kitty Hawk's stuff in advance of release, including a flight simulator and demonstrations and behind-the-scenes videos. Ooh. You'll also get a, quote, priority placement in the pre-order line. So basically you're paying $100 to get in line to get into the pre-order line. When it does open, a $2,000 discount off the selling price, which suggests that it will be at least a six-figure range. The first vehicle is designed for hobbyists and recreational use, but the company still has its sights set on making flying cars a practical reality for broader use, including as a means to alleviate urban traffic congestion.
Yeah, this is just a fancy water toy.
Oh, yeah, totally. That's it. Kind of disappointing, like, all things considered.
Larry Page, you're letting me down.
A little bit. But you want to know who's not letting us down in this market, James? Uber.
That's just sad, man. That's just sad.
Uber talked a couple of months ago about the fact that they were, amongst all their bad press, they talked about the fact that they want to get into, like, they want to be the Uber of the skies. They want to set up a network in New York and Dubai of self autonomous flying cars. the on-demand urban aviation, essentially a network of flying taxis that could be hailed via a smartphone app and flown from rooftop to rooftop. And then the company at the time made it clear that it never intended to go alone. Today, as it kicked off a three-day Elevate conference in Dallas, Texas, the ride-hail company announced a slew of partnerships with cities, aviation manufacturers, real estate, and electric charging companies in an effort to bring its dream of flying cars a little closer to reality. So this is actually kind of a cool idea, and I really like it. Basically, what they're saying is, hey, there is a need for this, but it's such a huge problem, you're not really going to succeed with one company. The vehicles are too expensive. The places to take off and land are too expensive. Like, the infrastructure is not there, but there's real demand for it if you can get it, if you can put all the pieces together. And Uber's basically saying, we want to do that. their goal is to get aviation companies to build devices specifically for this sort of thing. So helicopters, multi-rotor vehicles, stuff for hopping around a city, 20-minute flights, short things, but things that would that don't require a car. Obviously, their niche right now is they're going for rich people. if you're flying from rooftop, you got to have rooftop access first. but yeah, they're focusing on five aircraft manufacturers to work on the design and production of lightweight, electrically powered vertical takeoff and landing vehicles, VTOL aircraft. And it launched a partnership with electric charging company called ChargePoint to develop charging stations for the Uber flying taxis. And it's a classic Uber thing in that they don't want to own all these vehicles. They don't want to own the charging stations. They just want to bring customers to these people. And
hey, you know, that's,
I actually kind of like it.
That could be a business.
I kind of love it. I'm like, that feels right, you know?
Well, and this is how they started out with their, back in Uber cab days where they were doing the black vehicles.
Right.
Super expensive, super high end, super limited. And people were like, well, you know, it's just for rich people. I'm like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
You're doing it again.
Yeah, exactly. And it definitely has a, it feels like there's something there. What the nice part about it is, you know,
transportation is a problem. That's what I'm picking up from this entire segment.
You know, and as much as it's fun to make fun of Larry Page's new Kitty Hawk flyer, the reality of it is the Roadster, Tesla's Roadster was a toy for rich people when that came out. And
yeah, but it actually got you play.
Yeah, I mean, it was very limited in range, but it was super high performance. It really, like, you know, it was the body of a Lotus, so it could fit half a person if you were normal sized. Like, it was a rich person's toy. You needed, if you owned that, you still needed another car.
That's true.
And they built Tesla on the back of that vehicle. So it's not a ridiculous idea to start with a gimmick toy to kind of work out the kinks, but at the same time,
that's fair.
It's optimistic, James. I don't know if it's
just
fair.
At the same time, you think like he's a big dreamer, you know?
Yeah. He's also very much a believer in the, you know, fight for every inch or die. You know, that's
minimal viable product, all that stuff. Yeah.
So, it's pretty cool. And also, and this is the final thing, I thought this was a very good read. This is from The Verge, and it is titled "Stop Calling Them Flying Cars."
really?
Yes. And they're basically making the same argument that they acknowledge they lost with hoverboards. They're not hoverboards. They're self-balancing boards. Why are we calling them
hoverboards?
but it is clear that these things,
wow,
they are not cars. They do fly. Why are we calling them flying cars? Like, what does that even mean in this context?
Well, we call it an iPhone, a smartphone.
I was going to say, yeah. To me, I enjoyed, like, absurd misnomers and non sequiturs. So I'm going to keep trying to call them flying cars. I might even go, like, further with it. Like, I don't want to call them airplane. Like, I don't want to call – I'm going to go to the airport, and I'm going to get on a flying bus. Like, I like the idea of that sort of just, yeah, it's whatever. But that's clearly what's going to happen.
vertical takeoff and landing multi-rotor vehicles, which is the future of aviation.
Work.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. But flying car for some reason does. So we're going to call them flying cars.
I come back to that idea of like companies do this all the time. And this is why I joke about the fact that I'm like, we need to just call the modeling work that we do. It's an AI model.
Yeah.
And even though it's not, but I don't care.
Right. No, that's not the point.
Because it has a brand, it has a meaning associated with it that people instantly get that they already want. And whatever. If you really look into it, it's not just like the hoverboard thing, but you're like, I don't care. It's a brand name.
Right. And honestly, flying cars is synonymous with a type of transportation. It's convenient. It doesn't require an airport. It flies, and it's small personal like vehicles. Like,
yeah,
it sums up whatever this thing is, in even though it's a complete misnomer. And yeah, I don't know. I like it. I'm all right with it, James. I'm okay with it. I think
I endorse it.
Yes, I think The Verge
we're
is
calling it a smartphone. We're calling them flying cars.
Exactly.
It's not a pocket computer. I mean, it is.
Yeah,
that's what it should be called.
And in some cases,
because you had the laptop, this would be the pocket top.
Yeah. And the crazy part is, in more and more cases, the most powerful smartphones are better, more powerful computers than the laptops. So. It seems more ridiculous that they're called phones. But like you said, it's all about that. It's a product category. People associate it and they understand what it means, even though it's...
So you're ever letting business people get involved.
I know.
Dumb marketers.
This is how the whole English language was built. And this is why it's such a freaking mess. It's because there's nobody standing on top saying, no, you can't do that. We're not... The Euros, like, their language is crazy. But they have people in charge of their language, making sure that nobody gets too wacky with it. English, man, we're nuts.
I was reading this article. It was talking about the word lead in terms of in journalism. It's called the phrase is burying the lead. In other words, the lead is the most important part of the article.
Yeah.
And when you bury it, it's like you started reading that one article and it was talking about how Waymo, even though they're embroiled in a battle with Uber right now, they've been able to take the time to, you know, like... That's called burying the lead.
Right, yeah.
Where you don't just start with, Waymo announced that.
Right.
There's self-driving rides, despite the fact that they're in a battle with
Yeah, and a lot of times the media will do that when they want to cover, when they want to say that we covered a story, but they don't want it to get much attention. So they'll talk about the administration doing something positive, but they'll put it on the sixth page and they'll only mention the positive thing after like four paragraphs of complaining about everything else they did.
Right. Yeah. And so, but anyway, so that phrase burying the lead,
yeah.
It used to be spelled LEAD, lead,
right.
Lead, however you want to think about it, until 1970. I was reading about this earlier today.
I'm curious.
And journalists internally started spelling it wrong to clarify what it was that they were talking about. And they started to spell it L-E-D-E. And then it wasn't until, earlier this year that Webster's finally went, you know what? This is now a word. And this is the definition of it.
That's so weird.
So, you know, yeah. Words happen.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So
English language is and what's really funny with like what I've been trying to learn Italian. So I'm learning more about like how other countries, when you have like a national language and there is one nation that controls the language, like French, for example, like there is a government agency that's in charge of defining what French is. And so what they'll do is when something comes into popular culture and starts to become a thing, if it doesn't really follow the rules of French, they'll say, okay, we're adopting it. We're making it the official. We're making it something official, but we're going to change it so it follows the rules so that the rules stay consistent. So the spelling, for example, it's like how you pronounce things. If pronunciations change and the spelling doesn't match the pronunciation, they'll change the spelling so that they'll be just like, no, this is how our language works, guys.
I guess that feels smart.
Don't break the rules. Yeah, but it requires...
Wow. I wonder how much politicking gets involved with that.
Tremendous amounts. I mean, it's sounds like it's absurd. But it's
oh my god,
and it can be quite this controversial. Awesome, yeah,
this is so awesome to get caught up in the spelling or pronunciation of something or the proper grammar use of a word.
But English being the terrible amalgamation,
dude, Wild West, I'm gonna say, here.
Being the terrible amalgamation of multiple languages. And having two
THRU, that's a word because it's less letters on a sign.
Yep, exactly. And the killer about it is that the biggest country on earth that has it as their like their primary language won't like. No, we. It doesn't matter that it's America's official language. We're too cool. We're flexible length languages, and
it's a melting pot of language,
which is cool, but it makes for one difficult language to keep
taco.
Up
with. Is that Spanish? Who was I talking with? I remember
burritos.
I thought it was the funniest burrito, right? Well, I remember it was this kid. I want to say he was 4 or 5,
yeah,
right, young, and he thought it was the funniest thing that pizza was Spanish, or it meant the same thing in Spanish as English.
Okay,
that's the way to say it. He thought that was hilariously awesome.
Just because
I don't know,
because he was 4.
Well, because he was all in a like, wait, how do you say pizza? Because you know, my wife, she's bilingual, and so he was like, how do you say pizza in Spanish? She was like, pizza. He was like, what? This is amazing.
Oh, no.
I know Spanish.
Oh, no, it happened again. You went away. Oh, right at the punchline.
That was great.
Wait,
wow, hey, man, flying vehicles and self-driving vehicles. And can you hear me?
You there, James?
Yeah.
Turn down your.
Are you there?
Yes, I am. Turn down your video quality if you don't mind. Can you hear me?
How's that?
Hi.
Yeah, I hear you just fine.
All right, cool. And then we're going to go on, even though I can barely hear you.
Okay.
So tell me. Yeah, that was good. I like it. So let's move on.
I was just going to make some comment. There's a lot of stuff going on in the driving world. Pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Pretty awesome. Was there like, what was it, a conference this week or something? I mean, there was the TED stuff, which I think, I just trying to figure out why all of a sudden.
I don't know. It was pretty amazing. I looked into it. I mean, Uber had their like flying, their conference this week in Texas.
Yeah.
But that got like the least amount of attention out of all of this. Everything else seemed to get more attention than that. And huh. I don't know. I think it was just a weird. Every once in a while, this happens, man. Things stack. Everybody kind of gets into trying to figure out transportation the same week. You know, everybody will launch a new software package the same week. So stuff like that. No coordination. They'll just step on each other's toes accidentally. Yeah, it's one of those weeks.
Purpose. Hard to tell.
Yeah, seriously.
Huh. All right. Well, speaking of stepping on toes, Ajit P. Ajit, by the way, whose first name sounds like a sneeze, has decided to step on the toes of the internet.
Oh man.
Oh my gosh, we knew this was coming, and it is here. Way sooner than I thought it would be. I literally, so parents were visiting, was that last weekend or 2 weekends ago?
It was last weekend. I'm sure it was last weekend.
I was talking to our shared mother about this. And and I was like, you know, this guy's making rules, Ajit, left and right. And I'm like, and you can tell like he's just warming up for net neutrality.
Yeah.
He's setting the tone. Setting how this is all going to go, and then he's going to put net neutrality up on the chopping block and just cut deep and could care less. And no, could not care less. There we go. And that happened this week. It was Tuesday, Wednesday?
Yeah.
I don't know how to. Net neutrality is dumb, according to him.
Yeah.
It is a mistake that essentially carriers were, whatever. They're called Title II. They fall under Title II rules, which essentially says all the things about net neutrality, where you can't block sites, you can't have fast lanes and slow lanes, you can't require internet or content providers to pay extra to make their content available. They can't even favor their own services and offer them for free and have it not count against data caps. So apparently there's a workaround around that law. But anyways, the idea is that as a Title II company, ISP, whatever, they need to leave internet access available to everybody. Well, Mr. Pay has determined that that's addressing a problem that A, is not a problem, and B, was not actually an issue at the time. It is just extra red tape and bureaucracy for fictional potential issues that have no evidence of them happening.
Hmm.
Is essentially his argument. To which at least 800 companies we know of said, no, we disagree, actually. There's some value to this. Notably, none of the ISPs were those 800 companies. And so it's a fascinating argument. So the idea behind net neutrality is to say for web companies and startups, people who are on the web, we want to keep competition as free and open as possible through these rules.
Yeah.
And Pay is essentially, or detractors of net neutrality are saying, well, we want open and free competition for the ISPs.
Right.
And therefore, we should let them do whatever they want. So they want free competition, quote, higher up the stack, if you will. And then it just kind of flows the way it flows down the stack. And the ISPs may or may not make rules that then inhibit competition for those content providers. And they come at it from a general philosophy, I guess, of rules are bad. The government is bad. The invisible hand of the marketplace will solve all problems in the end, which for me personally, I'm like, okay, yeah, in general, that's true, but not always.
Right.
It's good to have some sort of barriers and rules in place to help guide companies, because companies are run by people who are inherently greedy and will try to bend the rule where possible, and not just ISPs, but everybody. And ISPs are already doing it, but he's already shown that he doesn't care. And I feel like there's something going on with him that we're just not aware of. Like there's some sort of back deal or some sort of something. I don't know. Cause he's so like, just, we're just doing this. He's got an ideology and it's like, he's made up his mind and he's moving on. He's not hearing out any arguments. And the thing that I think that just like, that probably ticked me off the most about him was the whole making phone calls on airplane ban. Of him saying, no, that's a good rule. We're keeping that rule.
Right.
Because I like my flights to be quiet and I don't want to have to deal with that. Which, by the way, if you make a call over Skype, doesn't count. You can still do that. And, you know, FaceTime, we're good to go. But anyways, and planes would self-regulate and people would let them know pretty quick if they didn't want the phone calls. But so he's not just like this pure ideology either, which I think that's what like just bugs me the most. And even though they've so what he's done right now is he has like, he's made his statement and essentially said, it's kind of weird. So they're going to vote on May 18th on a notice of proposed rulemaking. So it's kind of like they vote to propose the rule.
Okay.
It's kind of weird. So like they're not just going to like vote and it'll be done. And then if the vote to propose the rule gets passed, then they'll have a final vote later in the year. And so apparently he has the power to like to just change the rule, but he's decided, no, we're going to do this way. We're going to be a little more transparent and open about it and whatever, which I think he knew what he was walking into.
Yeah.
And companies would flip out if he just did it, which it's funny. If he got rid of net neutrality, and I would say, like, I don't know, Google, I would say, cool, that's no longer neutral. We're blocking you.
Right, yeah.
You know what I mean? And just be like, yeah, you want to see what this looks like? We shall show you. And but that's me being more of a vindictive kind of guy. That's how but yeah, so net neutrality on the chopping block will probably be chopped because there's like three people who get the vote on it, and two of them seem pretty consistent in their vote.
I think to me it's I don't know. I mean, I hate to get into politics too much, but it's this is the problem of when companies and political activism push for the executive branch to write legislation through the form of these organizations. Like, net neutrality should be something done by Congress. And then it wouldn't matter
who
was the president, and it would just be, but you know, that's not where we are politically right now. And I personally think that as much of an issue as this is, and I actually do think that they're, you know, I we've talked about this before. I'm personally of the belief that ideally the government wouldn't have to step in with the ISPs, not because they're benevolent actors, but because there would be true competition. But there isn't true competition. Right. And since there isn't true competition, there needs to be some sort of regulation to protect us. But it's not.
Yeah, I have a choice of DSL or cable internet, and I have one company for both of those to choose from.
Right.
That's it. Now for phone carriers, okay, I guess I have like four or five probably to choose from there.
Yeah,
I guess.
And then I just think that if we were to,
and they just proven over time, you're right, they don't act by competition. They act more like an oligopoly where one company moves and the rest tend to follow. So you would get one company who would say, hey, we're doing this tiered pricing thing now for the internet. And guess what? Like in a month, all of them will offer that. And you just go, oh, okay.
Right. Even if you could grab more, the argument being that competition would compel them to give the best services to the best number of people trying to steal customers from each other. But that's not necessarily how it works. If they all get together and just agree, look, we're not going to compete with each other. We're going to make as much money as possible for our little piece of the pie, which is, it's just such an obvious thing that's going on. And it's so frustrating because it's like, yeah, the head of the FCC is totally being bought and paid for by the telecoms. And Google and Netflix hate it because they're the ones that are going to be most affected by it. They're going to be the most damaged since they don't own telecoms, and yet they use more telecom bandwidth than anybody. So they're the ones that are going to have to cut the deals. It's not really good for the final customer. Well, and that's the thing that irritates me most about it, is that ultimately this is a giant argument between Comcast and Netflix. You know, it's like at very few points along the conversation does it really get kicked over to most people, the smaller people, to be like, well, what's best for them? The biggest argument for, quote, what's best for us is that you could, if you were Google, it would be advantageous to pay these companies so that a third party couldn't come around, a smaller upstart would have worse service, and you'd have to pay for that. I don't know. I just, to me, this whole situation is just systemic of a bigger issue with how we govern ourselves right now. And as big of an issue as this is, it's very complicated. Not everybody's going to be happy. It's going to be decided by who's the biggest funder, who's the biggest lobbyist, not what's best for the people. And it's a systemic issue, which just makes me very impatient with it, because I'm like, it just, I don't know, it shows a bigger problem. And I will agree completely, though, that Ajit Pai seems like a real just
stooge. Just
yeah,
seems like stooge.
Oh, that's the word. Thank you for because I kept thinking of words that I didn't like that I also felt were accurate.
Stooge. Nice. I like it. I'm glad I could help. Yeah, he's a. Anyways, so I do want to bring up something kind of cool. This is a little more on the techie side.
Stooge. Yeah,
it's the sort of thing that I like to get into. ARM, the guys who make, how would you know ARM? So Apple, Samsung, Google, everybody who makes cell phones, they've got little systems on a chips inside of them. And they've got little cores inside of them. All that is those CPU cores are designed by ARM. And they're licensed to these other companies like Apple, Samsung, NVIDIA, and the rest. And they license this technology out. They don't actually make any chips, or they make very few small run proof of concept chips. When they do, mostly though, they develop intellectual property and they sell it to everybody else. It's actually there's a really good computer file on YouTube. They do a series with the original architect for ARM, and it's great because he's not super nerdy. He kind of stumbled into the position. And help them accidentally develop a market that has turned them into one of the most influential tech companies on earth. Because their stuff is in literally everybody's. But they made an announcement this week that's going to affect cameras, hopefully, probably. We've been talking about the last couple of weeks the idea of completely software cameras and how important software is in making cameras work. And one of the big legs up that Apple, Samsung, and Google have right now is they make their own image signal processor, which is basically you take all the software that you normally would write, and instead of having it run on the CPU, which it would do slowly, you imprint it into silicon so it does it incredibly quickly. Every picture you take, it does things like color correction and balancing, and it can even output different formats automatically because it's actually in silicon. It's incredibly fast. It's very dynamic. And even though a lot of phone companies will buy camera sensors from the same, you know, from Sony or from Samsung or whatever, their pictures won't turn out as good. And the reason for it is that they lack these highly specialized and sophisticated image signal processors that Apple and Google are producing on their own. So basically, this week, ARM announced their first ISP technology that they can license out to other companies. They claim theirs is the best of the best of the best. They, you know, we'll see if that actually bears fruit. But when ARM gets into this sort of stuff, they take it pretty seriously and they produce some pretty great technology. So this will just be like, this will be the exact same thing that they do with their GPUs and their CPUs, where third parties will be able to license this technology. And then when they stamp out their own chips, like the Snapdragon chips from Qualcomm or stuff that NVIDIA is making, they'll be able to integrate that directly into the processor. And so a phone maker now will be able to buy a camera module from Sony, plug it into a Snapdragon, and produce amazing pictures with very little effort. And so your very cheap phones that, despite having good camera sensors, produce bad pictures, will now be able to produce very high quality pictures. And
interesting.
Yeah, it's cool because it just leads a ton of there's now going to be more and more investment in the entire market into this. This has clearly become the future of making good cameras. And, you know, Apple gets a tremendous amount of credit for proving how valuable this is, because that has been the differentiator between Apple and everybody else for a long time, is Apple's amazing image signal processors and, you know, and just being able to really understand the limitations of a traditional camera sensor without any, you know, sophisticated lenses,
and turning it into a great picture anyways. And this is, it's funny, if you're having a hard time understanding what I'm doing, if you've ever seen like a photographer take pictures, normally they'll take a bunch of pictures and they'll bring it into Photoshop and they'll touch it up before they publish it. That's post-processing idea. And they'll do all sorts of, they'll adjust this and do that. And they'll like, just make it pop more. Basically what Apple does is they do that automatically. Now, Google, that's what an image signal processor does. And it does all the post-processing automatically. So that, yeah, you end up with these amazing, beautiful pictures. They can get rid of dead pixels, all sorts of crazy cool stuff to make it really improve the picture. Mm-hmm. Beyond what,
interesting.
Yeah. That's cool stuff. It's exciting. Huh.
Well, speaking of not exciting, the Chris Sacca has decided that he's done investing.
Yeah.
Good job. Boom, done. So Chris Sacca, he's an investor in Twitter and used to work at Google. And he's been on Shark Tank now for a year or two, maybe. He's at one point in time was arguably like the most successful VC guy in the Valley.
Yeah.
And he's quitting.
He's out?
Yeah.
Why?
He had a goal. When apparently he had a friend who asked him, what do you want to do when you grow up? And he wrote an answer down that he found, that he said he would have a job that involved a lot of time on the phone negotiating, and overall it would have high risk, high reward. And he envisioned it being a very lean operation, possibly working out of a bare warehouse, and he would also do it halftime from the mountains and halftime from the beach. And the last thing is that he'd quit when he was 40 to try his hand at something else. And he goes, well, most of these days, negotiations happen over email. He goes, I do risk every single dime. And he goes, it's one of the best ever. And it never had a formal office. And he spends half of his time in Truckee, California. And the other time near Los Angeles.
Mm.
And he goes, in a matter of days, he's turning 42. So, yeah, and you'll appreciate this. He goes, thus, to dig up the deeply buried lead. he goes, he's retiring from startup investing. And essentially, he's like, he's good at it. He's conquered it. He's made enough money. And he has two kids he wants to hang out with. And he wants to try something different. All that to say, the companies he's currently invested in, he's going to stay invested in, and he's going to keep working with them, but they are no longer going to be putting new money into new companies. So he's done, just like that, which is kind of a bummer.
Yeah.
He was a character and a half, which is probably what made him fun on Shark Tank. And he always had an opinion about Twitter and how it should be running and what it should do. He shut off his mouth. He was the guy who had the story about Travis being the number two person in Wii Tennis.
Oh yeah.
The world, like he shared that story, which someone started digging into it and was like, "Well, hey, there's no such game called Wii Tennis, and if it's talking about the Wii Sports Tennis thing, there was never an online player thing."
Yeah, that's a good point.
So, what was he number two in?
Yeah,
well. which is more of a criticism of Chris Sacca than Travis,
right? Yeah,
but which is one of those like, huh? I never thought about that. Weird. By the way, Nintendo decided not to comment on that story, so super funny. Yeah, so he's getting out of the game, and it sounds like it's not a problem. He's just ready to move on.
Sure.
Sounds like he's going to do a podcast because podcasts are awesome.
Spend more time with his family. I know this.
Yes. Yeah. Well, being that like it's him and one other guy, I don't think he got fired.
Yeah, probably not.
But yeah, anyways, just kind of, we'll probably hear more of him, but less from an investment standpoint. I still think one of his best interactions was on the Startup Podcast, that very first episode, where he's pitching him the idea to to start up a podcast company. Yeah. And he's like, all right, you got me for 5 minutes. Give me your pitch. And he starts and he goes, that pitch is horrible. Here's how I would pitch it. And gives an amazing pitch. And the guy's like, oh my gosh, that's so amazing. I want to do that company. He goes, well, let me give you the converse side.
Yeah.
Here are your risks. Here's what it's at. And he, you know, pitches against it. And he goes, oh my gosh. Just utterly defeated. Oh, amazing. And so good, so good. But oh well, he's done.
Yeah. That's, you know, hey, I look forward to seeing what he decides to do with his life next, man. You know, what's his next 10,000 hours going to be about?
That's a great question.
Woodworking. That's my bet. He wants to do something with his hands.
Yeah, get off the phone.
Yeah.
Go make a boat.
Go make a boat.
Or a flying car. That could be cool.
I know.
He's not an engineer, though, so.
That's why I'm thinking the make something with your hands, because non-engineers always think they can do that and be easy. It actually is pretty easy if you're just a little detail-oriented. That's the hard part. Be patient.
Yeah, totally. I hung a pull-up bar in my garage this
week. I saw.
And it looks amazing. And that was one where it was like, just to do it was like three times the amount of effort that it should have been. Because I actually had to go up into the rafters, up into the attic, and add another piece of wood that I could actually drill into, and I had to move insulation. I was just involved.
I say, that seems like the classic, this is way more impressive than it looks.
Yeah, because you don't see any of it. It's just this hanging down bar.
Yeah.
It's just there, but it doesn't fall when I get on it, so that's cool.
That's the important part.
And it's just high enough that if I'm like fully on it, I don't touch the ground. Nice. I'm like an inch off of it.
I got lucky that at work we have a it's not a pull-up bar, but it's what it works as.
A bar you can pull up.
Exactly. On. And so I've been using that for years, and I just do it a couple times a day. It seems pretty good. Take the weekends off, let my back relax.
Cool. Awesome. Well, that's all we got this week.
Awesome. I like it. I feel good about it, James.
Good stuff. Awesome. I'm glad to hear that. Awesome, awesome, awesome. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us and for listening to episode 292. We really do appreciate it. Don't forget, you can check out all the show notes and all the links at furloughbros.com. And if you want to get the show notes sent directly to you, you can sign up on the same page on the right-hand side. And then finally, this podcast is supported by listeners like you. And if you'd also like to contribute, we have 4 different levels. You can be a fanboy, a nerd, a junkie, and a maven, which is awesome. Again, furloughbros.com. Check it all out. So on that note, I am James Furlough, and my not-so-well-rated circle of a brother is Matthew Furlough. And so we will talk next time.